Our high school guidance counselor used to ask us what you would do if you had $1 million, didn't have to work. And then invariably, whatever you'd say, that was supposed to be your career. So if you wanted to fix old cars, then you're supposed to be an auto mechanic.
So what did you say?
I never had an answer. I guess that's why I'm working at Inatech.
No, you're working at Inatech because that question is bullshit to begin with. If everyone listened to her, there'd be no janitors because no one would clean up if they had $1 million.
If I had $1 million. If I had $1 million.
Talking about millions of dollars.
What would you do if you had $1 million?
I'll tell you what I'd do, man. Two chicks at the same time, man.
We're living in a material world and I am a material girl. Or boy.
Well, what about you now? What would you do?
Besides two chicks at the same time?
Well, yeah.
Nothing.
Nothing, huh?
I would relax. I would sit on my ass all day. I would do nothing.
Well, you don't need $1 million to do nothing, man. Take a look at my cousin. He's broke, don't do
If I had $1 million, if I had $1 million, well, I'd buy...
Hello, I'm back to Saxon Jackson. I'm Tim Howe. We got Andrew on the board. SP Futures down 675. NASDAQ Futures down 28. Big day today. We've been had two boring days in a row, waiting for the big Fed meeting and in the aftermath, and we have, of course, all kinds of intrigue on the Fed. There was a new guy confirmed from the White House, which is a little strange, that it was in the meeting today. The lady who was fired is also in the meeting today because the appeals court said they couldn't dump her before the meeting. So we got all that going for us. So as if these meetings weren't intriguing enough to start with, we got to add some stuff. But that's what we do. We have Professor Kevin. Kevin, are you there? Andrew, I don't hear him.
Looks like he's in our call.
Maybe he's... Kevin, unmute thyself. We're also going to have a new guest on today, a gentleman named Bob McShane. I played softball with him forever, and Bob is... he'll tell us all about it, but he has a very working knowledge of the steel industry because he... I believe he has a patented coating for steel that... gives it a big lifetime, and I think it's a dry coating. We'll let Bob explain this, but basically we wanted to talk a little bit about the steel industry and who the players are, and we just had the big deal with U.S. Steel and Trump coming up with the big deal with Nippon and somebody taking a piece of it. I think maybe it's him personally, but I don't know. And whether or not whether they were a big enough player to have that happen. And we're just going to kind of go down the list and who's who, not for an investment thing. And we're also going to talk about whether it's an expanding industry, which we kind of hope it is, if stuff comes back to this country, and what are the jobs available and what are the skill sets needed. And Kevin is also very good at that because he can let us know what his school and other schools are doing to maybe meet that need. So at some point, one of the two will come out. But the Fed this morning is expected to cut by a quarter point, which of course will bring an onslaught of criticism from the president that it should have been like 2 points or something. But, you know, you have all kinds of points of view on that. And I think we got to be careful we don't zero ourselves into a stagflation sort of situation, which unfortunately I think there's a pretty good chance of. We also had a couple incidents in Chicago yesterday. We supposedly had an ICE incident where this guy's broke into the front and the back door of some guy's house and had the wrong house. Of course, they're all wearing masks. I don't know if they even identified themselves. And that's interesting. I wonder who you send that bill to. And we also have somebody got shot by an ICE guy the other day. So we got sort of issues going on with that. Still no Kevin, eh?
No, nothing yet. Not right now.
I hope everything's okay. Well, we'll talk a little bit about the market. And we had... yesterday we had, a little bit of a down day, but not much, but any kind of a down day is a down day these days. S&P was down 8, NASDAQ was down 14, which is the first time. We had a little back up in gold, a little back up in the GDX, back up in silver, which is somewhat interesting, because if they're going to put more money in the system, you kind of wonder what the situation is going to be. And if more money goes in, I mean, there actually was a headline here in the on CNBC today regarding Morgan Stanley. We got mortgage rates have dropped a little bit, and the somebody talked about us going into a stagflation thing. It was, but But the weird part is, we mentioned, God, some of the stuff we talk about on the show, we wonder, you know, why is this Oracle spinning up so much when it looks like they're so way ahead of themselves in terms of price? And I was talking to Wayne, and he said, well, we were talking to Wayne last Thursday when Wayne and Andrew were on, and talking about how Trump's kid is bestest buddies now with Larry Ellison's kid. And now they really got their nose in the government. And now is the announcement yesterday was that evidently they're going to be they're going to end up with TikTok, them and some other outfit. Well, that's interesting. Andrew, how much do you use TikTok?
I think there's actually four outfits that are involved with the TikTok deal.
But
Oracle's definitely one of them.
I think they were the biggest. The other guys were 20% or something. Anyway, nobody knows the details yet. But
well, just to answer your question, I think one of the only few my age that has never touched that app, and I never will.
Really?
I can't stand it, and it's not for me. But basically, everyone else I know, you know, uses it.
What are the alleged advantages?
I wish I could answer that. It's so, the content is just so quick, and the platform kind of knows what you want to see. So you don't choose, you don't sit there and go, okay, you know, I'm going to watch this 5-minute, 10-minute video on this or whatever. You just sit there and keep scrolling, and it's 30 seconds, 30 seconds, 30 seconds, all of things that, you know, the algorithm knows you're going to want. For me personally, I can't stand that. I'm like, I'd rather watch.
So the idea is on for 30 seconds and disappears? Is that the deal?
Not necessarily it disappears.
Oh, that's Snapchat.
Oh, I see. All right.
Yeah. But it's just, it's like constant, like, essentially just new info being thrown at you.
Really? From who? From other people or from some news source?
Oh, yeah, it's all, so TikTok is, well, to compare it to Snapchat is like a messaging program where that's like, you know, like you add your friend specifically and you're literally just messaging each other. TikTok is more like an Instagram where it is, you know, like you have content creators, people who are making, let's say, like, you know, videos on like video games or like joke videos or this and that. They're all over. So it's kind of like, you don't really know the people personally. You're just kind of following people that are creating content and that gets recommended to you.
Really? Well, nobody has a job and nobody's playing softball. Everybody's doing this stuff.
Well, now that is a job.
Now that is a job. Well, there you go. Kevin, are you into all this? You're Mr. Tech.
No, not very much.
What about your students? Well, your students are more worker people than...
Well, I have different groups of students. So, you know what I get is my younger technology students, they tend to be more into video gaming, online gaming.
Really? I remember we had a pinball and then we had Pong, remember?
I remember Pong.
Yeah, it was like, wasn't that the first one? After pinball machines? God, it was a thing boring. But anyway, pinball was pretty cool. I don't know if you get a pinball machine now, I guess they're worth something, huh? Can you get anybody to fix a pinball machine? Who the hell knows that? You ever see one of those things when they pull the top up, how many wires and stuff were in there? Long before printed circuits, eh? Crazy stuff. So what's up in your world? Anything good?
Well, I'll tell you what's good is actually... the Cubs picked up another game on the Padres last night. That was good. So what's going on there is it would be a monumental collapse by Milwaukee for them to catch Milwaukee for the division. But as far as the wild card, they hold the number one wild card spot. So with 11 games to go, they have a 5-game lead on San Diego for that number one spot. So magic number, that would be 6. You know, any combination of 6 Cubs wins in 11 games and Padres losses in their 11 games would give them that spot. And that spot's important because the first round of the playoffs is 3 games and the top wild card team gets all 3 at home.
So there's 3 division winners. The top 2 get a bye.
Yeah.
The crummiest one and the best wild card get to host a best out of 3 home series, correct?
That's right.
So our buddy Ricketts will get three home games, which he's got to be gleeful about.
I'm sure he is.
Do we have a Bob, Andrew?
Sorry.
Morning, John.
Hey, Bob, is that you?
It sure is.
Bob, you ran with Kevin O'Neill, another softball player, although he's retired. He's retired. I thought this would be kind of fun, Kevin, because Bob, remember we talked a few weeks ago about U.S. Steel and the deal there and what kind of player they are in the industry and so forth. So I thought, hey, here's my chance to get Bob on, who knows all about that industry, to try and give us some kind of a view of is it growing, which we hope it is, you know, less maybe overseas, more here, and what kind of job skills those places need and how much of your stuff, which you guys do, matches up with those skills, because I suspect there's sort of a match. So welcome, Bob. So first of all, tell us what you do. You're in the coating business, right? But you know where all the steel companies are coming from. Is that correct?
Well, I got a pretty good idea. Thanks for the invite, by the way. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning.
Yeah, we're involved. We manufacture equipment for the steel industry, which applies a powder coating to the surface of the steel, and we do it on a continuous basis. That is that the steel is moving, the giant coil, if you think of a giant roll of like a paper towel, if you will, as that's moving, we have a powder coating, we apply it to the top and the bottom, it goes into an oven and it's cured. And then following that, it's re-rolled, and then it goes to just a variety of end markets, most prominently the building sector, primarily because the coating itself and the chemistry involved, it's a very robust coating, so it can handle the harsh weather conditions, excuse me, and other types of conditions where you have abrasion and excessive wear on the surface.
Is it like highway girders and stuff too?
That's coming. We're pretty new. We've started up. Our location is down in Memphis, and we're just as a matter of fact, the sphere that is out in Vegas has been coated with some of our product.
Really?
Metal that holds that sphere together. So that's one of the...
Well, just as a poor man's iteration of this, the stuff at the Civic Center, which is now the Daily Center, that building was designed to rust, and the rust itself was supposed to be a protectant, right? And yet, when you see on the highways, they used to have all that red stuff, which was some kind of a primer paint, right? And now it's all gray. Is that dry or is that a paint? What's all that?
Yeah, that's a paint. I was never a strong subscriber to let steel rust and or any kind of cosmetic or wear characteristics. It's really not a good property to, in my humble opinion, it's not a good property to have. Metal is best when it's coated. Of course, I'm in the coating business, and I would say that, but. Yeah, you know, actually we've talked to Trinity Industries down in Texas about, they're the largest manufacturer of guardrails, and we've proposed to them a coating system not only that will protect the guardrails, but it has reflective flake, pardon me, that's been put into the powder so that you have a dark road and when the lights from an automobile hit the coating, it has reflective properties, and that's one of the new ones we're working on.
So for your factory, what's the skill sets involved there? I mean, how would Kevin's school fit into this? Are these guys chemical people? Are they manufacturing people? Are they metallurgical? What are they? Or all of the above?
Yeah, the plant in Memphis is a what we call a metal benders plant. The labor there is probably, well, it's all local folks, but it's more of a train on the job. The skill level is not extremely high, except for you know, the guys are in the office. They've got They've got one metallurgical engineer on staff, and but they really rely on their corporate headquarters, which is Steel Dynamics out of Fort Wayne, to provide a lot of the, if you will, upper-level engineering support there.
Well, that's one of the names on my list I was going to ask you about, because, I mean, the upshot of this was the U.S. Steel deal, and obviously, I mean, to anybody who's given a message, you know, president or whoever, we want to make sure that if we have a defense industry, clearly we can't make an aircraft carrier without somebody can make some steel. I mean, duh.
That's very true.
So
Steel Dynamics also, isn't part of their business the recycling steel?
Yeah, they have a sister company that they own called OmniSource. And Omni, I believe, is the largest recycler in the United States. Omni is an accumulator, so they bring in, be it cars or wash machines or other types of metal products into their facilities. Kevin, they have some of the most dramatic equipment that you've been, and maybe you've seen it, where what I mentioned, the autos and the refrigerators go into a shredder, and it literally takes it from its present form and rips the car to pieces. And then they have magnetic separators that pull out the iron, and so the copper and moly and stainless and other products go in one direction, and the carbon steel goes into another direction. They accumulate that in extremely large buckets, which is compressed, crushed, if you will, and then that goes over to the electric arc furnace, where they introduce that product and they melt it. So,
Bob, when the stuff used to leave General Iron here before they kicked them out, the stuff would leave in this huge flatbed, you know, what do you call it, like a massive dump truck, although it was bigger than a dump truck.
Yeah.
And then the steel looked like, it almost looked like something the size, maybe 1.5 times the size of your phone. It was like wafers or something. Is that what you end up with?
Well, there's a couple of processes. OmniSource has various locations around the United States, and they will segregate that scrap by its content, and then they actually can pelletize some of the scrap. They compact some of it, as you say, in smaller type of units, and then they have ones that are about as big as a Volkswagen. So they're a pretty dynamic group of folks there at Omni. They have locations all around the U.S. And I believe they are the largest recycler. It's just incredible to witness the scrap that comes in and the conversion process that takes place to turn it into usable material to melt.
And that stuff can all be structural. It can be a girder on a road, right?
You name it. Yeah, that's exactly. As long as it's carbon steel. You know, they like to keep, but copper is really a problem, because copper you really can't get out. It's got to be diluted. But so they go to great lengths to try to separate copper from the mix. But they're pretty interesting.
Well, they were on my list, Kevin. I also have Cleveland Cliffs, Nucor, Commercial Metals, and then of course U.S. Steel, and then there's some smaller ones. These are ones that are traded. I guess my question is, well, I don't want to, I guess it sounds horrible, but if U.S. Steel went toast, and it, right now, if somebody went out for a bid for a bow of an aircraft carrier and wanted the steel, how many people can fill that order? Is it 2 or 10 or?
Oh, there are plenty of people in the U.S. that could fill that. Nucor could do it. Steel Dynamics could do it. ArcelorMittal could do it. The thing about U.S. Steel, which is very unfortunate, is, as you know, it's been in Gary, and it's been the Braddock Works in Pittsburgh and elsewhere. It, you know, it was a juggernaut for many, many years. they allowed. It's kind of funny. I went to a trade meeting one time where Nucor was just starting their process. Now, you got to understand that the folks at U.S. Steel versus the... But U.S. Steel is a basic oxygen furnace shop. So they bring in the raw materials, iron ore. They have a mix of limestone and coke that they add together in what's called the BOF, the basic oxygen furnace. And that's what produces, it's pure steel. It's virgin steel from, obviously from the iron oxide that they do there. The folks at Nucor and at Steel Dynamics and Big River and a few others in the United States, they are different. They take scrap, they melt it, they refine it, and that's their product. The difference between the two products is that the U.S. Steel product initially is very pure. So they will add chrome, or they will add molybdenum, or they will add elements to it in order to meet a metallurgical certification that is designed by the end user. For example, a ship in the Navy. And those ships have a certain class of steel. Obviously, you have to be able to weld it and rivet and all of those, but there are very strict specifications. However, when you look at meeting those specs, only in a very rare instance would the Steel Dynamics product not be able to make the cut. They could provide essentially everything. We do need virgin steel. There's no question about it. There are, you know, a variety of, for example, if you look at the top of your automobile, all of those components, the outside, the trunk, and the hood, those are all virgin steel products. And the reason for that is when that coil is made, and then, and we don't coat that product, by the way, but when that goes into an auto plant, when they put it into a stamping press, the requirement to have the steel bend and move to the contour of the die is extremely critical. So that there's temperature involved, pressure involved, and when the die goes down and it clamps on the surface of the metal, the purity, the metallurgical purity of that steel allows that to take the form that it does. On the secondary side, the people like Steel Dynamics and Nucor, their product is more contaminated, if you will. I hate that term, but so they've had difficulty making that type of product. But the thing you got to keep in mind, you know, there's a lot of steel poured in the United States, and not everybody has to make the components for automobiles.
What is who is in that? I'll use the term virgin business other than U.S. Steel.
Yeah, ArcelorMittal is, Cleveland Cliffs is.
Well, Cleveland Cliffs bought. They just bought one of the big ones in Indiana. They bought somebody, didn't they? They buy Inland, or who did they buy?
Yeah, that was a while. Inland's been gone for a while. Inland, LTV, and Bethlehem were all giants, original steel, virgin steel makers on the lake, and they're all, well, they have all been purchased. So, I think Cleveland Cliffs, if I'm not mistaken, purchased ArcelorMittal, but
they did, I think, because they're right by Portage there.
Yep, that's exactly right, yeah. I spent a lot of days in that
mill. Well, the Southworks was a massive facility, and that's gone. The Gary's,
yep.
Gary's half the size it used to be. They used to have a rail mill. I don't know if they do anymore. Is there competition in like railroad rails and things like that? A couple people do that, or a bunch of people do that?
The big guys, U.S., lost that business a long time ago. As a matter of fact, they lost it to both Nucor and Steel Dynamics, who, when they installed in their mills, when you see a railroad track, it has a certain length to it.
Yes.
One of the things the secondary guys did when they built the mill, the rails that they make are considerably longer than the rails that were made by the big players in the industry. So they load those onto rail cars, and I mean, Tom, they're long. They're like three rail cars long. They have significantly dropped the time it takes to install rail simply because of the length and the lack that, you know, they don't have to weld them like they did before.
Well, there's a couple of things on YouTube, because a knucklehead like me watches, about installing new rail or getting the old rail out of there. It is spectacular. Kevin, have you ever seen that? They've got like five or six of these cars, whoever designed them, but there's one where the rail's sitting there, and they pull the old one out, and then this thing runs on a rail across like four cars, and they drop it down, and they shove all the stone under off it and keep going. It's really something.
It is. It saves them a lot of time and effort putting those in. And plus, they're nice and straight, so that's...
Kevin, pile in here. Is anybody building a mill, or is our capacity, when we say bring stuff back from China, do we need more mills, or how much do we get raw steel from overseas?
Yeah, it's a fluid market. The United States, you know, could they use another mill? Somebody would have to make a business decision about that. We have plenty of capacity in the United States.
Yeah, and that was going to be my question, is do we have the capacity now, and just say, you know, with what we have, do we have, you know, 20% more capacity, 30% more capacity available that we're not using yet?
No. The mills that are operating here are, it's reported on a weekly basis, the capacity utilization, and we typically in the United States are running at somewhere between 70% and 85%. So, we have plenty of capacity. The thing you got to keep in mind about a steel mill is that they are in great need of maintenance on a very regular basis. You're looking at 3,000 degrees liquid steel that has to be handled and manipulated. The wear and tear, Mother Nature, you know, just builds things. The ceramics that are involved work well, but it wears out. So like the Gary works, that's been going on since like 1913. And it's not to say that they haven't made upgrades. They have. They've done a lot of improvements there and to keep that place working. But it's tired. And that's why they got themselves in trouble. And when the Japanese came into play, a lot of people got upset about a Japanese company. But U.S. Steel needs that. They need that infusion of cash and an infusion of new technology to keep that mill viable. So I see that they're hiring, and
who are they hiring, Bob? What kind of people?
Well, they're hiring folks from the neighborhood. These are guys that are coming in, going to be training to be millwrights, and primarily maintenance people who are involved with use of ceramics and mudding up the troughs that pour the steel and things like that. They when you look at places like Rose-Hulman and Indiana University, and Indiana's got a number, as well as Illinois, have a number of schools, have great metallurgical engineers, but the majority of people that they need are those that literally run the mill, that are in the plant, driving the trucks, and making sure everything operates as it's supposed to. Some of those are extremely well-paying jobs, by the way.
Bob, Kevin and I have been discussing for a while, the interplay between, where it's going, who knows, but the idea of foreign investment plus government investment. If there's six, seven companies, like you say, there sort of are, U.S. Steel puts together the proper business plan, says, look, we need X investment, all of a sudden it's going to mean in 3 years we make money, 4 years we make a lot of money, whatever it is. Why all of a sudden and this, you know, I don't know if you want to answer this question, can't we go to the market or the bond market and get the investment the normal way? Is that the way of the dodo bird? Whatever, we got to snivel to a foreign company, we got to snivel to government. I mean,
well,
go ahead.
You know, Tom, it's not real sexy. Making steel is not like NVIDIA or some of the other folks that are on the front page of the Wall Street Journal. You know, as you know, steel's been around a long period of time. And I would say there are some on Wall Street that understand what steel is, but it doesn't get a lot of attention. And I think if you looked over the stocks have been good earners for a lot of people for a lot of years, but I don't think it draws the because it doesn't bounce like some of the sexier markets that are out there. The steel makers report, the AIST and some of the other mags that are out there, you know, they are reporting what their output is. So every month there is all of the steel makers reporting what kind of results they have. And so it's a pretty, I think the term is languid market versus some of the things that, you know, a lot of people, and you deal with them, I'm sure, every day, they want to get in, they want to make some money as much as they can, and then, you know, go on a holiday someplace.
Well, that's not a bad idea, actually.
Not a big kill type of investment area. It is, you know, if you succeed, you have to be in for the long haul, take your good steady growth and returns, and call it a deal. But it's not going to be that exciting one where it's going to run up in the next month, and you're gonna walk away with a ton of money.
Kevin, why don't you take over? Kevin, ask some questions. I've been talking too much. Go ahead.
Well, I'm sort of interested in just to give you a little background. I teach at Ivy Tech, so if you're familiar with Indiana, you're familiar with Ivy Tech. And my areas of responsibility at the moment are IT and supply chain management. So, you know, I come at it from actually both of those points of view. So let's start with the IT point of view. What are some of the skills the employability skills that people need from the technology world to get into the steel business? Where's the demand there? I would assume that there's a certain amount of networking and so on, but it's really going to be infrastructure, I would presume.
Yeah, it is. They this isn't an old business where I see guys with hammers and big ladles of steel. I mean, you still have them, but the folks behind the scenes are extremely focused on IT. All of the deliveries, shipments, and related, whether it be via air or sea or on land or rail, that infrastructure has been fairly sophisticated for some time with the mills. The number of the rail car and what's going in it and how a programmer, that is all done at the mill. And then when it comes to communicating with the folks on the outside, where's the order, what car is it on, when's it expected? So all that has reverted to a digital platform that is it's fairly sophisticated. They their customer service folks could basically, if you, for example, you ordered that rail car of rails for a railroad, they could tell you where that's at, when it's expected to be delivered, how many's on the rail car. So that, you know, they... it's not like when you used to call them up on the phone and say, hey, where is it at? And the guy says, hey, give me a couple of days, I'll get back to you. I'll tell you what, Kevin.
Platform?
Go ahead, repeat that, Kevin, and come through.
Is that built on a blockchain platform?
I believe it is, yes.
Yeah.
Now, so the thing that you will, I would think, take a big interest in is that AI is coming into play. And we are in a process with our facility down in Memphis where we are implementing a digital twin. You're probably familiar with that. On the process line. And what it will enable us to do is to understand, monitor, and be able to manipulate all of the hardware that is conducting the line from start to finish. Never had that before, but what it will enable us to do is on a instantaneous basis be able to make a modification. If we have a motor that appears to be failing, if the strip, if the steel strip is running through the line and it's starting to move in a direction, we'll be able to make a correction. The temperature of the oven and any modulation that's in there, the feed rate that we have on our coders is all feeding into this AI system, and it will essentially enable us to run that line, and more importantly, well, obviously you got to run it, but more importantly, to monitor the wear and tear that we have, so that when it does come to a maintenance program, we know exactly what to do, we know exactly what the parts are that are going to have to be replaced, and we can do it at a time when it's most convenient, rather than, you know, you're running the line and all of a sudden something breaks and it's, Mother Jesus, now what are we going to do? And you're down for a week.
So, yeah, and there's a couple of kind of technologies that you mentioned right there. So, when we're looking at the monitoring, this is basically every component in your process, self-monitoring, self-reporting, and telling you, you know, it's getting time for calibration, it's getting time, I've got some kind of heat sensor problem going on, so... And then, and then you can actually divert production around it while you're reacting to it. And the digital twin for the listeners is basically you create a virtual reality version of your entire, can be your entire factory. You can build it out for your entire supply chain. But then whether you're talking about how you want to reconfigure, if you want to move things, if you need to be able to test. Some things out, you're doing it in a virtual world, because as you can imagine, trying to test what you're going to do with real equipment means shutting down your process, means giving something a try with the opportunity for it to not be the improvement that you had hoped that it would be, and all of that being tested in a almost a video game type of world, where you can you can back it out and try again and try some different things and say, okay, now we're ready to lock in, let's go ahead and make our move.
Yeah,
is that a fair description of what you're
doing? Yeah, that's you're right on the button there. In metal plant, you're dealing with a lot of weight. In some cases, you're cutting, or something. In our case, we're coating. And it's not a cheap material. So
and if you do it wrong, it's not easy to undo. Coating is an interesting process, but you're either going right to scrap or you're doing rework that is going to be very expensive.
Yeah, the beauty of our operation is that in the event there's a hiccup and something goes wrong, we take the steel. We send it back to the mill. They melt it and they make new steel from it. So it's not a complete loss. But in any time that you have a problem, that you have something break or you have downtime, Kevin, time is money. And one of the big things you can afford is to forego that type of maintenance cost, because we're talking. It's a lot of for our oven, for example, goes up to 550 degrees Fahrenheit, and it is an infrared oven where it has these specialized bulbs. Well, it you can imagine if you have a dead bulb, and you have the steel that's passing it with a high quality coating on it, but a bulb is out, that means that the coating doesn't cure. and now and we're running at 150 feet a minute. If you didn't know that bolt was out, now you've got a length of steel that product is not cured. Not that it would wash off, but that'd be a real problem, because somebody would get that on their garage door and it would start to wash off, and it would not be a good thing.
How thick is the stuff you're running through there?
Our average is between 1 mil and 2 mils thickness.
All right, so we're not talking quarter inch or
1/1000th of an inch. So it's thin, but then again, the chemistry that's involved and the difference. So you paint your walls at home, and when you use a conventional VOC, a volatile organic compound based paint, it dries. Ours does not dry. When we apply our coating to the surface of the steel, it literally fuses to the surface of the metal, which gives it its exceptional properties as far as corrosion and scratch and fade resistance and things of that nature. But you don't want to waste paint, but you want to put it on, and then in that process, you want to do it right. So it's important for us to know that all those bulbs are operating at temperature, and there are four banks of these ovens that are involved. It's a vertical tower, and it's some 60 feet high. So if you do have a problem with it, now you got to go up on the mezzanine.
Who designed something like that? I mean, how did somebody look at your process and you know, I know you've been doing this for a while, and you're finally making some serious headway. Who said, okay, the tower's got to be 60 feet, not 55 or 65? I mean, who's capable of that? I mean, the reason why I'm asking is we had, from time to time, one of my buddies from the South Side, imagine that, a civil engineer who's now retired in Texas, said he loved his career in there. He did water treatment plants and stuff. He said it's an absolutely spectacular career. But he says you don't find hardly anybody taking civil engineering courses anymore. Kevin, are there people taking metallurgical engineering at Ivy?
Not for me. Yeah, we do have an engineering program, but normally what they would be doing at our place is the real basic level, and then they'd want to go on to, you know, Purdue or someplace to finish up their bachelor's degree.
But is it the same thing if you get your engineer's convention the first day of school? Is nobody at the civil desk? Is nobody at the manufacturing engineering desk, and everybody's doing computer? Is it a popular thing still, Bob, or not?
The educational interests of the world are kind of interesting at the moment. So, you know, I get IT students, for instance, and everybody comes in, and you know, half of them think they're going to be video game designers, and they're not. But that's an aspiration that they have. And so part of my job, because I get them, you know, I try to get as many of my students as I can in their first class and their entry-level classes, and I try to give them the overview. Now, we, you know, big interest in cybersecurity now, that's a hot one as well. But, yeah, we get a lot of people who are in, you know, and I'm not in the industrial side, so I don't have robotics, I don't have engineering, you know, those are not in my area of responsibility, that's part of somebody else's. And they do keep their programs going pretty well. Where I'm getting a lot of traction right now is in the quality management world, and you know how to go about approaching it. So, but you know, when we are talking about, you know, the coding process as an example, or any of those, you know, they generally. Most manufacturers are going to be talking about what their first pass yield looks like. The first trip down the production line, how much of that stuff is done right the first time, every time.
That's exactly right.
And so that's the big deal. And, you know, I have talked to a lot of companies that say, well, our goal is to have a 97% first pass yield. And I sort of listen to that and shake my head. So, I mean, you're okay with 3% of your stuff being unusable. You know, that's just not that's not sustainable. That's an it's a real expense, especially when you're in a world where you're talking about inflation. So a lot of your cost structure has been stressed out, and now we're going to throw tariffs on top of it, where you might wind up having to eat those. Because I keep telling you, customers are going to pay what the value of the product is. They don't care if you have to pay a tariff on it or not. So you better be able to manage the cost. And the best way to get cost improvement is, if you're looking at 97%, move to 99. And in the Six Sigma world, you're talking about 99 and a whole bunch of nines after that. So that's really... that's the one where, you mentioned earlier, I get a lot of older students who are coming back because they've been in manufacturing. They realize and kind of live in the world of trying to improve, continuous improvement world. And that's sort of the sweet spot that I'm pushing right now.
Well, Bob, did you start out as a chemical engineer for his coating stuff, or manufacturing, or you just got an interest in it, or how did you start?
it's one of those typical funny stories. I got a bachelor of science degree in chemistry from Illinois Wesleyan University, and I lived over on Western Avenue at 109th Street, and that my landlord, believe it or not, was in the metals business. He ran a company that was involved with the investment casting industry. It has nothing to do with stocks and bonds. And if you look at things like golf clubs and propellers for Mercury Marine and very sophisticated airplane parts, those are made via the investment casting process. And he asked me one day, he said, "Hey, would you be interested in a job?" And I said, "Absolutely." And that's what got me. And I was very fortunate because, Kevin, what you're talking about a lot here is physics, and I didn't have a master or an undergrad in physics. I did enjoy physics a lot, and it is now what's involved in what we're doing, even on the electronic side of it. The physics are tremendous, and that's one of the things that we had to conquer when we applied our product, Tom. Our coating is 3 microns in size, and that's pretty small.
Not a lot of space there, huh?
It's small. So when the manufacturer produces the powder, we have to take that and we have to move it in air. We electrostatically charge that. Here we come with the physics. We electrostatically charge that particle, and as we're moving it, it then goes onto the surface of the metal. It goes to ground, and then it goes into the oven and is cured. Now, our strip is 48 inches wide. So the nozzle for projecting the powder onto the sheet is also 48 inches wide. And if you've ever swept your floor, which I know you have, imagine trying to get all of that material that you're sweeping, just for example, if it was sawdust, how do you get that to move in one direction with uniform spacing between the particles and electrostatically charge it? So, we learned how to do that. It was a lot of pain and suffering, to tell you, because there were many people, as I was developing this technology, the biggest players in the game, the folks at PPG and Sherwin-Williams and U.S. Steel and a number of Alcoa, they all were of the same opinion and said, "You can't do this." And so God bless Steel Dynamics, because they had a different opinion, and today we're in the commercial
field. Well, how did you know you could?
I didn't. But I did know that the current technology was what they call gun technology, which is which is that it's a gun. It's a handheld device that the powder goes in, electrostatically charges it, and the biggest market today for powder coatings is with a gun and things like your wheels on your car, the aluminum wheels on your car, and rims on bicycle. There's a myriad of components that are powder coated today, but they're done by a human being holding this gun that projects the powder onto the metal, and then it typically goes into a box. They close the box, they turn on the heat, and 30 minutes later they take the parts out and voila, they're done. What we've been able to do is to take that moving sheet of steel, apply the powder to it uniformly into an oven, and then recoil it. So what we can do literally in 2 minutes, it takes somebody in another plant to do the metal and then coat the metal, it's days of process.
Who dreamed up the chemistry for the powder? You?
Just because I run a softball team on Sunday mornings doesn't mean I don't know what's going on.
I was going to say, but even if you're the bright dude I think is behind the softball, it had to be, this had to be your 100th iteration, 200th?
They never kept count.
but it was up there, huh?
It was up there, yeah. I wouldn't say it's not 100. We probably have had 45 or 50 iterations.
Bob, we have Russell Rhodes, who's a professor at Indiana in the room, and he has a question. Go ahead, Russell.
Yeah, sorry. I'm sorry to take you off track a little bit, but I was listening earlier, and you were talking about quality a bit, and the other guys on here know that I'm fixated on China and just about everything that they do. And you hear about cheap Chinese steel, and then you hear about the quality of it is not, what you would want. What do you do if you're a customer and you order a bunch of steel from China, and when you take delivery, it's not usable? And how do you tell it's not? This is almost like a multi-part question, but how do you tell it's not usable? What are the repercussions? Is there anything you can do about it? And is it really an issue, or is it just something that I hear about on the internet that's not really an issue?
No, it's an, well, you probably know, Russell, that the U.S. government, when they, as you know, they purchase a lot of steel, they have placed an edict on the purchase of steel that they will not buy Chinese steel, and the reason for it is substandard. That's the first, when the Chinese figure out how to do something, the first thing they do is how to do it cheaper. There is now you got the steel industry in the U.S., but then you've got the service center industry in the United States. The service centers are the main buyers of steels. It's not your Mercury Marine or it's not your General Motors. It's the service centers who get the steel, and then they convert it into a finished shape that the end user, if he's making a wash machine or whatever he might be making, can use. And that service center are the guys that take the steel and they put it on some type of a lathe or a grinder or some piece of steel, some machinery that convert it to its finished form. And if you don't have the proper metallurgical properties, not only can you ruin tooling, but it can be dangerous to an operator if that particular piece of steel were to break or to cause a drill bit to fail. So they're pretty careful about it. The Chinese are interesting folks because they have, they have no conscience about what they sell. So that's why they change things as they do metallurgically to make them cheaper. And you know, it's all a price driven equation for them. And I'll tell you a little story about China, which I think is interesting. I'll give you a little flavor of what they're like. So several years ago, a fellow that's on my board was commissioned by Reliance Steel and Aluminum, which is the largest service center in the United States, to go to China and to look at that they had a they had an operation there where they were producing a finished, let me just say, a finished steel good. And to build a line in the United States to finish that product was in the realm of between $30 and $40 million. Now that, you know, it's a pretty big investment for a U.S.-based company. So Roger went to China, and when he got to the facility, he couldn't believe it because he said it was the largest plant that he had ever seen. And when he got there, he was there to look at the one process line. They had 15 of these lines that they built. Of the 15 lines, one was operational. So, you know, they literally just threw money, and they've done the same thing in the steel industry. They've thrown money in order to build volume. But not all of the mills there work, like in this case, all of those process lines. Only one of them was working. So, and this is a real story. This is the real deal there. And
Bob, who are those guys here now? I mean, because Central Steel's gone, Ryerson's gone. I mean, who does the middleman work here?
Oh, there's some giants in the market. Reliance, again, they're the largest in the United States. They must have 100 operations around the United States. But Worthington Steel is another one. They're based in Worthington, Ohio.
But none of them are in Chicago anymore, it seems.
Well, Chicago sucks.
Well,
you can't run a business in Chicago. You know, they. It's awful here. This is not a city anymore.
Did you try and do something here originally before you went to Memphis?
Yeah, we did. There was a line at 46th and just east of Pulaski, and I went down. I met with the owners there, and they were decommissioning this coating line. So I wanted to work a deal. You know, I can drive there in 20 minutes. I wanted to work a deal with them to recondition that line with the powder coil technology, and one of the things the general manager says, well, you know, you need to talk to the alderman. So I said, what do I need to talk to the alderman for? Yeah, so I forget what the guy's name was. Called him on the phone, and he said, sure, I'll meet with you. I got to his office. He wasn't there. He had me meet with one of his second-in-commands, and you know, I told him what we do. We're in the steel business. His eyes lit up, and you know, we got guys that got men and women that have to come in and work, and these are good jobs. They're good paying jobs. And believe it or not, honest, as God is my judge, he said to me, we get six.
Six
what?
What
that means, don't you?
I'm sure it's some Chicago jargon. Six.
We get six. That means six of my employees I would be paying for that are his people. They never show up to work. He gets six.
Bob,
so
when did
I
this,
knew right then and there that it was not the place for us to be.
Bob, when did this, I use the term change, when I'm not ashamed of it. I was a Chicago janitor forever, and I got the job because of somebody who had connections. I never missed a day. I was the best guy there. Why would anybody give me the job and never show up? They never crossed anybody's mind when we were kids that you would get a job that you wouldn't even have to show up for. I mean, did I never got one. Did you?
No, I never did. It's the Chicago way, Tom. It's you know, there's a lot of people that are in downtown Chicago that are collecting a paycheck, and they do the minimal of work. I mean, and it's the way. You know, why do you think our costs are through the roof like they are?
Well, you didn't hear that video gaming is going to save us all. I heard that this morning. Did you hear that, Kevin? We're not going to have a lot of the video gaming in everybody's restaurant. Now, if your Bally's putting up this casino, God, is that like a shot where the sun don't shine or what?
Yeah, you're talking about gambling.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just want to make sure because that's different from video gaming.
Well, video poker and stuff in all the restaurants and bars now. And they had four or five of the slack-jawed aldermen being interviewed this morning. I was here on the way in. Man, we just can't pass up $60 to $120 million. Buddy, do they even know it's a tax on the people who can least afford to pay it? Do they even care?
Yeah, you wonder.
Well, where do they think the money comes
from? People have to make money to play those machines.
And
you know what? Every time I go into a place that has those machines, nobody's ever playing them.
There's some of the most, even JD's private men's club on the south side, you know, the Gano, Bob, they make like a grand a month from the couple machines that are in there. It's scary.
I'm hanging out at the wrong places.
Well, there was a, Audrey and I go to the, it's a Pepe's, but I don't know why they even have a Pepe's, but it's a really nice Mexican place in the Homer Glen. And, so we go in and they have like one or two waitresses that make $120, and on the way out, they blow $50 on the machine every day. I mean, it's scary. Nobody knows the odds. Those machines, you would think, and this is kind of off topic, but it's a little bit interesting. This is, I'll use the term, the wheel of gambling. You know, we started out with the tracks, then we don't want the tracks anymore because other guys got made more money somewhere else. Now you got the casinos. Well, now you take the money from the casino. Those video gaming machines in poker or whatever the hell they are, the state is the casino. It's not like that the casinos the video gaming machines in Chicago are going to be tied through Bally's. We just want all this stuff to get the license. They're no part of that. They're a state competitor. So essentially the state has their own slot and video casino that they're running. I don't know where most people think that there's some private enterprise is part of that. They're not. The state runs it. Now they're going to give the city, what's it going to be? Is it, everybody heard it this morning? It's $500 for the license, and it's something per month per machine or something. It's a boatload of money. But now that's going to be the solution. I walk into one of the...
Before I deviate you too much, I'm really curious about landing down in Memphis. And how that, because you talked about the negative implications of dealing with an alderman up here. I'm just wondering
can't tell, Russell's from Memphis.
And for full disclosure, I grew up there. And my assumption is you guys are out on President's Island. See that, yeah. right there, you know what I'm talking about. So there.
Yeah. I sure do. You know, I didn't know shit from apple butter about me. I'm sorry.
Oh, that's okay.
That's all right. You're in. Yeah,
I do that all the time.
So, you know Memphis, and you know where the airport is. So we are north and east of the airport, not but 15 minutes, and we are next to the largest rail depot in the Midwest. It's BNSF, and there's a huge industrial park, and that's where we're at. Okay. It's brutally difficult to keep a quality staff on board at the plant. It's not mine because you know, my guys are very well paid engineers that are working there, and but the people that run the line are, you know, they're hardworking Joes every day. There are no females there. It's a male dominant environment. You know, you work with steel and leather gloves and protective gear, but Memphis is no fun. It isn't. It's the number one murder capital in the United States.
I'm
Chicago, we're number one in total, but Memphis and St. Louis are bad, and it's really a shame because it's been a music hub forever.
Yeah.
And when you look at Beale Street and all of the activities right there in downtown Memphis, it's in a very confined area. But so we stay at the Fairmont there. Every morning I get up, I'm up early, I go downstairs, I have a little breakfast, and every morning they have the local TV on. And I realize we're getting off subject here, but as you watch the TV in the morning, the two things that stand out most dramatically are, number one, during the news broadcast, the volume of crime that takes place. And then the second thing that you notice are the number of commercials for law firms. It's unreal. They're not advertising Tide, or they're not advertising McDonald's. It's unreal. It seems like other commercial is a law firm.
It's definitely a different kind of place.
Also, quick question.
Folks, let me, I got to go, so it's time for me to check out, but I will be listening to you as I drive into the office.
Kevin, thank you. Good questions as usual. You and I will do our usual stuff on Friday. We didn't even get a chance to fight today. What does it matter? What's wrong with that?
I'll call you later. We can do it.
Yes, right.
Hey, I have a question on the crime stuff. Eric May, who's come on the show, hopefully we'll have Eric back one of these days. But Eric, he ended up being a teacher, retired teacher and writer from Columbia. But when he first came out of school, he was a beat writer on Washington, in Washington, D.C. And he kind of kept up on that stuff and on the reporting stuff. And he, for a while, the real hotbeds of crime and murders, what the hell did he tell us on the air one day? There used to be, a couple of murders a week in Washington that he would have to go out and report on. And then one week there were like 12. It was the week that, what was the drug of like 40 years ago, guys? Was it oxycodone or crystal meth? It might have been crystal meth. As soon as it showed up, all of a sudden the murders exploded, and there were distribution centers. And when the distribution mm-hmm. center got too violent, the guys would shift distribution centers. It went from, he said, from Washington, then it went to Elizabeth, New Jersey, and that became basically a bleep hole of bullets flying. And then they went to, it was Elizabeth, New Jersey, Jackson, Mississippi, and every once in a while they would shift cities because the city
Little
got...
Little Rock was one like that for a while.
Is that one of Memphis?
Memphis was definitely like that. Anything that's along one of those east-west expressways, it becomes a place.
Well, St. Louis has got to totally be like that. God,
I think that's why East St. Louis is kind of a nightmare because of its proximity to I-70.
Russell, do you have any questions for Bob?
Had one, and I just had the brain thing, but also I brought somebody from an engineering school along, so she may have a question.
Fire away. Who are we talking to?
Good morning.
Hey, how are you?
Dr. Ademiak.
How are you this morning?
See, Bob, you're around with all these doctors. We'll have to call you Dr. Bob now or something.
he's the steel doctor. Now I'll be quiet.
Okay.
Yes, I've been thoroughly enjoying listening to the discussion about steel. It's truly fascinating. And last year, or no, I take that back, 2 years ago, we, in the I-Corps program at IU, we looked at a company that did powder coating. So it's really fascinating, and the applications for it are just phenomenal. It's just, as you were pointing out, it's expensive to do. So there's a lot of things that could be coated, but it's cost prohibitive. And it was also one of the things that came out was that it's more sanitary. Is that correct?
Yes. What's interesting about it, Larissa, is that the particulate itself, the actual powder products, unlike a liquid paint system, if you take an antimicrobial, Aegion is one of the ones that's popular. It's the silver ion is what it is. It will physically attach to the particulate, and then as it goes through the heat cycle, it remains in situ as far as the paint system is concerned. So you do get a very robust product, and we have had calls from some of the big players in the HVAC industry for coating the inside of ductwork and air conditioning and heating systems, because you're right, it lasts a long time, and it prevents, it doesn't kill, but it prevents the growth of bacteria. So yeah, it's pretty unique stuff. At the time, AK Steel was doing the work. They were over in Middletown, Ohio, and they've been acquired. But it's a number of very unique things that you can do. Again, I come back to the physics of it, and and we do, by the way, steel and aluminum. So that opens up an entirely new world of opportunity for us, because you can imagine the number of aluminum cans that are in circulation today, and all of them have to be coated on the inside of the can, because your product can't handle raw aluminum. So you have to dull, if you will, the inside of a Coca-Cola can so that you don't lose that great taste that you get from Coke.
But what happens when you, I know a little bit about, well, making a railroad car. So when you get your coil of steel, as they used to say at Pullman, nothing ever changes. You slit it, you bend it, and you punch it, right? So what happens when you've coated the sheet, but I don't need it 48 inches, I need it 12 inches. So I slit it. Now I've opened up a spot that's not coated. Then I'm going to bend it to where it's a 6-inch by 6-inch corner of something. Do I wreck it by bending it? And then when I punch it, then what? Do I open up bare metal again there? Now, what happens after that?
Yeah, well, you don't ruin it. The elasticity in the paint system, again, this is not liquid paint. So
okay.
It will bend. It's called a T-bend. 0, 1, and 2 are the factors that are used in a T-bend. And it's all a function of how, you know, is it a 180-degree bend? Is it a 60-degree bend? And you actually design the paint system to, you know, whatever that bend characteristic is. So it's, again, it's not paint. It looks like paint when you see it, but it's a coating. What we use are a combination of polyesters and a couple other paint systems, because of the line that we're on, we had to develop a paint system that would cure fast and cure uniformly across the strip. And so we built that both into the size of the particles of the paint, and we have a fair bit of epoxy that is in there as well, which is a great product for getting the phase change to take place in the paint system.
Doctor, what's the clamor at Purdue? Dr. Demack is now at Purdue, Bob. She was at IU, now she's at Purdue. What's the clamor for, is there a clamor for chemical engineering, metallurgical engineering, and civil engineering? Is it nobody want any of those?
Oh,
yeah, well, I'm a member of the, Larissa, the Purdue Technology Center.
Oh, great.
Yeah, I have been. As a matter of fact, just as a sidebar, they are tremendous. And the reason I can speak to you today is because of the help that the Purdue Technology Center gave me when I was just starting. You know, they were one of the people that said, gee, this is a good idea, you know, and they were of assistance and enabling me to get a $1.5 million grant from the state of Indiana to do much of the early R&D that was necessary. So I have a very, very fond place in my heart for Purdue University.
Excellent.
But yeah, there's no question. What I think is interesting about what we do is that, you know, as you as the young people are looking at their phone and making apps and all that, here we are in the industrial sector. We're making parts for all of the we're early yet, but we are able to design a paint system to bend or to be antimicrobial or to sheet water quite efficiently, and it all comes down to the design engineering of the powder and the process. So I like to think that we're kind of an example of American ingenuity, where you look at things to do, you know, what current processes. And my thing was, hey, why? I worked for Material Science Corporation, and when I was there, we were the number three largest liquid VOC based paint applicator in the United States, and we did both steel and aluminum, and it went everywhere. Whirlpool was one of our big clients, and Ford was a big client, and we put liquid VOC based paint on steel and aluminum, and it went into a myriad of markets. And a fellow, Dr. Frank Graziano, who's gone now, but he was a great friend of mine, and we kept saying, there's got to be a better way. And, you know, at the time, powder coating wasn't even on the radar screen, but there was information available about it. And we started looking at it, and we said, what if we could take this stuff, if we could put it onto the steel, get it to stick, hence the electrostatics, and then fuse it to the surface of them, what would we get? And, you know, here we are today. So when you're at Purdue or IU, and two great, by the way, Rose Holman, I don't mean to, but they're another tremendous institution that Purdue asked me to consult with some folks who had ideas, and they asked me to talk to, you know, I've done everything from laundromats to car washing, you know, people looking for, hey, how did you get going, and, you know, what did you have to do? But it's just that inquisitiveness that's necessary to, you know, I guess that's probably, you know, why do we have a cell phone? Well, you know, Steve Jobs and a bunch of those folks said, you know, how do we do this better? So
you know why we got a cell phone? Because of Star Trek.
Yes, sir.
Hey, Chief, just to loop around to your Purdue engineering question.
Yeah.
They're one of the few schools where mechanical is extremely popular.
It is, okay. Yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that's kind of like a niche-y type thing for them. You know, you have a favorite daughter of mine, the one over in D.C., who today's her first day at the White House.
Wow.
I had to work that in somehow. But the other one is thinking about tagging a mechanical engineering major onto her meteorology major and doing an extra year at Purdue now.
Well, good for her.
After being there 3 weeks.
She's already signing up for another year after being there 3 weeks?
Yeah, I mean, just costing me more and more money, man.
I think the popularity of the engineering programs are too good.
Yeah. So no, she wants to actually study tornadoes, so she wants to try to build equipment to do the study that she wants to do, and she realizes she needs a mechanical engineering degree as well.
Well, we're going to go to break here, Bob. We're going to boot you up only on the idea that you'll come back, because I have a feeling we've got more questions for you.
Yeah, well, I do have to run. I have an 8 o'clock teleconference, so I better get...
This was great. I hope you want to do it again.
Thank you very much, Bob.
We're not done with you.
Thank you very much.
The I have a softball story after after break about Bob. SP Futures down 1, NASDAQ Futures down 5. Big Fed day today. Be right back. Stocks and Jocks.
Hello, this is Tom Howe, the Chief. I think most of you know that I'm also the Chief Investment Officer at PTI Securities and Futures. There we invest for and help a wide variety of clients. And you know what? No two are the same. Some have legacy stocks, some concentration issues, some maybe embedded tax issues. The others might need or want some portfolio protection. There could be estate issues or maybe new family members. The point is that we are all unique and the portfolios should match. However, the last several years have seen a relatively one-way market. It seemed that all we needed was to be all in. No protection, no fixed income, just be all in, no matter who you are or what your risk profile or age. Most management firms love that. Take this and like it, no matter who you are. Be careful with that. You are not everybody. I think most see the market view going forward as maybe different than the one looking back, so your portfolio should reflect that. Maybe it's just as simple as your life station has changed. Towards that end, we are accepting some new clients needing a more personal approach and are interested in negotiating the future and not with a portfolio designed for the past. Find me at 312-663-4310. That's 312-663-4310.
Stocks, jocks,
stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now.
Low and rollback stocks and jacks. I'm Tom Holland. Andrew on the board. S&P futures down a buck, Chuck. Well, December's down a buck. September's down a buck and a half. Those will merge on this Friday. It'll only be the December. September NASDAQ is down 6. We've got the Dow up 35. Nothing going really crazy. McDonald's up $2. It's kind of hitting the Dow. Well, yeah, United Healthcare down 3. It's been up. NVIDIA's down a buck and a half. So, say, it's a typical 2.5 days of snortum before the Fed thing this afternoon. Over in Europe, DAX up 11, call that flat. FTSE up 23.2%. CAC around down 14.2%. So again, nothing going on there either with all the stuff that might be going on today. Nikkei down 111.25%. They've been on a tear, which we'll get Russell to comment on. Hang Seng up 469, 1.8%. 26,908. It's as high as those guys have been in a while. Shanghai up 14.4%. Bonds unchanged at 402, unchanged. Oil, 64.28. It's been a high of like 64, a low of 62, right around 63 forever, but it's 64.28. So I guess that's a very minuscule breakout. Brent down 22 cents, 68.25. Gold, which has been on a tear, not so much today, down 18 bucks. We'll see if it holds 3,700. It's 3,706. Silver down 91 cents. That's a 2% move. 42 bucks there. Copper down 8 cents, 456. So I don't know what people are expecting out of the news today. But dollar is, it says dollar rises from four-year low versus euro, but euro is over 118. So not much of a rise there, 118.4. We're also going to have our two professors comment on what a 2% move in the currency does and how severe that is for people to do currency trading back and forth. British pound is 136.5. It was under 135 a couple weeks ago. And we have last but not least crypto down 241 on the Bitcoin, 116.443. Andrew, what do you got for us? Quick traffic weather sports.
All right. It is Wednesday, September 17th, 7:36 here in Chicago. Just a loss from the White Sox. That is 8-7 against, it just pulled up here a second ago. Let's see, yeah, that was against Baltimore, 8-7. And we have a 1 from the Diamondbacks and a win from the Cubs. Over Chicago weather, it is looking pretty good today. It's 65 degrees, it's going to be sunny and warm. We're going to have a high of 79 degrees. Over in Phoenix, looking pretty similar, just a little bit warmer. They're going to be at 85 degrees right now. And throughout the day, they're going to have a high of 103. Still a mix of warm skies and some sunshine. Finally, for Chicago traffic, no major accidents to report, but things are looking pretty heavy on every inbound expressway. Only outbound expressway to take note of today is going to be the Edens. Things are running really slow on there. Going to take you about an hour if you're running the whole way. So, that is all I got. Back to you, Chief.
Well, guys, that was not a very great view of Chicago that Bob gave us, was it?
No, it was not.
I don't know how
Or of my hometown. I love how he described it as an outsider. I really did. So, but nobody cares about Memphis but me on here, so we will move on.
Well, the thing of it is if you're in Chicago, somehow you get the feeling that the crime is based just here, and it's not. It's a national issue. and it has to do with a lot of it is lack of jobs, a lot of it is a lot of everything. I mean, it's a and both sides politically will argue back and forth about, you know, sort of draconian measures, and yet nobody actually sits down and figures it out, which is
Memphis is the it's the next place that Trump sent in the National Guard.
Well,
and one of my friends sent me a picture that indicated the National Guard is definitely on the way. Our favorite strip club used to be Pink Pony, and it said National Guard and it gets free entry.
We had a couple incidents there in Chicago with the ICE people.
Yeah.
Regarding somebody got shot and killed, and somebody's house got raided, and it was the wrong house, and the people busting in are wearing masks. I mean, what the hell? But my buddy, my attorney friend, Bill Murphy, you know, he's a little older than us, and he was called him, you'll love this, Larissa, I don't know what you think of this story, but he was in the National Guard, called up for the 68 convention here in Chicago, and they're pushing all these people back. It turns out one of the people he was pushing was his wife.
Oh, no.
Can you imagine that? but, you know, and Bill is a very, very bright guy. He's still, you know, an attorney, works every day. Knows more about the skeletons in Chicago than anybody else. He said, National Guard has no business doing this. He goes, he was in the National Guard. He had zero training for an arrest. He had zero training for a traffic stop. You want to bring somebody in to guard a building or something so the police can go do something else, it could make some sense in some type of a riot situation, but the idea that they're going to come help the police, he goes, is the worst idea anybody's ever had, because you're not trained.
It's like giving, you know, an 18-year-old $2 million to play college football.
Yeah.
No, their brains are just not developed enough to handle the situation they're being put into. The worst thing in the world you would want to do is take 19-year-old me and ask me to help defuse or guard a situation. Trust me. And I think I'm, you know, a little bit smarter than the average 19-year-old. so
you had the brain of a 21-year-old.
Time, maybe. But I still would not have given me a gun and put me anywhere with the ability to exhibit any power over anybody.
Well, about a month ago, I don't know if you've heard it. I don't know if they have them in West Lafayette, Larissa, but there were actually ads on the radio in the morning. I'm driving in. It was for ICE agents. They were going to give you a bonus. They're going to either pay or do something for your student loans and pay a, you know, reasonable amount of money. I mean, what is the training for an ICE agent? Is it as long as it is for a policeman, or is there any training? Is there an ICE academy someplace that I don't know about?
I have no idea.
I assume that there is some sort of onboarding. You probably get benefits. You know, you probably sign something saying that I'll behave at work, but you know, they'll probably put you out on the street in 3 days.
What, you know, what is a police?
You can't wear custom masks, only black masks. You know, you got to follow their rules.
You got to buy them from them?
Yeah, that's probably it. You probably have to buy it because it's made in the USA that you have to buy a $19 mask.
Well, this morning here, and Russell just happens to be, you're our accent expert. NVIDIA pissed off because China has banned AI chips. What is the current status back and forth with China and NVIDIA and these places? I mean, one day they're a buy, next day they're a sell. I mean, can you put a thumb on the pulse of this and figure out what the hell's going on?
I don't really think that NVIDIA, I mean, I know they've sold a lot to China. I don't think it really, because they're higher end, higher margin stuff, they're not allowed to sell over there anyway now. And there's enough demand everywhere else to supply to you know, take care of what NVIDIA can make probably for the next 5 years, and they can keep ramping up as fast as they can. But I don't think China's that important to them. I just don't. I feel like anytime you hear, you know, something negative China-wise with NVIDIA and the stock sells off, that it's been giving you a chance to buy it.
Yeah, one of the best investments, which I don't do for any of my people, probably would have been the Hang Seng 4 months ago. Why?
Yeah, I'm shocked at that. Well, it's the same reason that assets get pumped up in the U.S. The Chinese government is just pumping money into their economy to keep it afloat.
All right, sorry to do this to you, Lewis, but how do they do that? What's their float? I mean, here, you know, we can, well, as Russell was ranting and raving on yesterday, we're supposed to be buying treasuries, okay? That's what they're supposed to do. But whenever they feel like it, well, in times of alleged crisis, they bought all the mortgages, right? So they put money in there. How does China have there? Is there that much float of Chinese bonds outstanding that they can essentially print money and go buy them? They do it the same way as here? I mean, their Fed can't be as strong, or are they?
No, their Fed isn't. Their Fed isn't as strong, and they do run the risk that they won't be able to continue to buy the securities. They also try to, or at least they have in the past, try to artificially manipulate their currency through these buying of these securities so that their products are going to be cheaper, which then brings in more money into their economy, which allows them to keep buying bonds. So it's part of this cycle that they're looking to constantly push down their own currency, again, so that it's cheaper for Americans to buy their products so that they can keep growing their economy that way.
Listen, are they more like...
Chief, one other thing that's slightly different with the way that they're able to, for lack of a better way to say, create money, is their savers are forced to buy their government bonds.
Okay.
So there's like a cycle that's going on there where, you know, I get paid, I pay 20% in taxes or whatever, and 10% of what I make is automatically put in the bank, and that 10% goes right into Chinese government bonds. So it goes right back to the government.
Well, just in terms of rules, I mentioned that here the rules, God, all we do is break rules, but we're supposed to be, the Treasury can only deal in federal government securities, correct? Well, now they went off board and bought mortgages, and of course the rumor for years and years, in a big down day, the Fed's buying SPOOs, right? And I don't know if they are or they aren't. But in Japan, they clearly buy stocks and companies. Didn't at one point, Russell, were you the one who told me that they owned 32% of half the ETFs or something?
My understanding is they owned, the number that was in my mind right before you asked me that was, from recollection, they owned about 30% of the broad-based ETFs.
See, that's why I hit 30%, because you're the one who told me that. No,
yeah. It was something along those lines, and that's what they were doing with, you know, we were doing quantitative easing and buying our treasury bonds. They were doing the same thing and buying everything. And don't be shocked if we eventually follow that, unless we get some growth going.
So I guess as we get back to Larissa, so they're liable to buy anything, not just the Chinese bond, I guess. Is that the fair assessment? To get money in the system?
Yep. And again, it really helps their economy in the long run, because their primary goal is to make sure it's easy for us to buy their goods. And so when Russell was talking earlier about the poor quality of products, so not only are they trying to reduce costs and give us cheaper products that are genuinely cheap, they're also looking to make them as cheap as possible with the exchange rate. And as long as those products are cheap and Americans demand these products because we are so consumer driven, they will continue to be able to prosper this way.
Well, I mean, I think, you are a proud mother. I don't know if you ever had like 8 or 10 kids or something. I don't think so. But when you, as much as you might want to buy stuff that's, I'll say, more quality in America, if you descend when you're buying 6 kids pairs of blue jeans, you're good, and you're not, you know, you're not the one percenter. You're going to end up at Old Navy buying the crummy blue jeans. I mean, they used to have, because, you know, I used to be 6'4". I'd have to, you know, buy all my stuff pretty much by, you know, L.L. Bean or something, because they all have talls, right? Every one of those things, L.L. Bean, Duluth Trading, for a while, they all tried to have Made in America blue jeans, Made in America khakis that were roughly 25% more than the other ones. Every one of them did it for like a year or two and then stopped doing it because nobody bought them. I mean, it's just, as much as you like to say, yeah, I want to buy America, I mean, you sit there and go, all right, these blue jeans are 60, these are 85. What the hell? They're not that much better. I'm buying the ones at 60. I mean, plus if people are tapped on cash here, I mean, you're a mother. You shop for the home. You know what I'm talking about. I mean,
I absolutely know what you're talking about. I also like to throw another part into it. All their friends are wearing clothes from Old Navy. So it is the fashionable thing for them to do is to buy similar clothes that everybody else is wearing. And I'll give a small shout out to Old Navy, and I probably shouldn't, but my kid likes Spider-Man.
Okay.
So we have the Spider-Man shirt from Old Navy. We have 6 copies of it so that he can wear it every single day. And we are not the only buyer of this specific shirt. This shirt has been sold by Old Navy for maybe 5 years. I'm thinking closer to 10 years because it's that stinking popular.
Wow.
So not only are you trying to save money, but you want your kids to fit in. And if you're in an environment where that's what everybody's wearing, you're going to shop similar to what everybody else is doing around you.
Well, my first experience there, and not that anybody cares, is I used to buy, you know, polo, and actually I think the best shirt I ever bought was when Abercrombie and Fitch first opened up. God, how long ago was that, Russell? In South Seaport, New York? Was that their only spot? That shirt must have been perfect after 50 washes.
Wow.
And so I go to Old Navy and I say, hey, these things look like polo shirts. I bought like 3 or 4 of them. I think they were like 5 washes a piece. I had to toss them. They did.
Sure.
But if you got a bunch of kids going out and ripping them and playing football in them, what's the difference?
Oh, absolutely. Or if your kid only wears Spider-Man shirts, that's what you're going to buy.
When's he going to get tired of those? Then what are you going to do with them? Give them to Goodwill for the next kid?
Probably.
You know, Chief, there's actually what you just talked about. There have actually been studies that have been thrown out there that the people that buy the one shirt that costs an awful lot that lasts forever actually is doing economically better than the people that buy the really cheap goods that they have to replace once a year.
Yeah.
And like the average low income person does end up spending more on a shirt than people that you know, are buying the nicer shirt that they wear that lasts them for 15 years.
Well, this is not a shout out to Notre Dame because used to be back in the...
Well, you can't do that with us on here.
Well, what I'm saying is I used to, when I go down for a game or something, Champion used to supply everything in the bookstore for everyone. When Champion was a real company, right? So, but if you went down there and, you know, you bought a Notre Dame basketball shirt or something, well, in that time of my life, Larissa, there wasn't a day that went by that I didn't play basketball or handball or something. Those things were good for 100 washes. They were that good. They were real heavy cotton. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm talking about after a handball game and they're all sweaty and everything. They were good for. Now you can't buy anything like that. They were $20 45 years ago, you know. Mm-hmm. But they were the real thing. And now I don't know. Champion makes is like that. I mean, they were bought by somebody else and everything. And of course now, Adidas is the Champion place at the, you know, they run the bookstore at Notre Dame and so forth. Who's the mm-hmm. Who's the benefactor to Memphis? Are they a Nike or what kind of?
They're a Nike school. They're a Nike school because Penny Hardaway, the basketball coach, and he's one of those players that got a lifetime contract with them.
Okay,
he gets $1 million a year. And there's also a Nike distribution center in. There's a Nike distribution center in Memphis where. On Fridays, they used to have kegs and pizza for the guys, and I would deliver the pizza.
I hope you guys aren't having a whole bunch of problems on campus with this murder in Utah. Has it caused any disruption?
No, I was with the Turning Point kids last week at IU Indy, and they did a prayer vigil. Had about 100 kids show up for it, and 3 kids showed up and acted like complete jerks. But they were quieted down very quickly, and everybody moved on in life.
What were they doing?
They were being pretty disrespectful.
Oh God,
that's crazy. And, yeah, no, they were, you know, but they were doing the prayer vigil on the lawn, and it was get the fuck off our lawn. Nobody cares about that guy. I heard a couple of those things, but a security guard diffused it really quickly and just said, "You guys need to stop." And they stopped and moved on. So I've dealt with security all over the place. The security at IU is just unbelievably great.
They
do a good job.
This whole thing listen, how many fathers do you know teach their kid how to shoot a machine gun? Like this.
I have yet to meet one, but that doesn't mean that they fathers are necessarily sharing that information with me.
Where do you even buy a machine gun?
I have no idea.
You know, we don't want to talk about better stuff with you guys, but remember? Oh God, I'm going on a plank here. You remember, used to call him Weird Harold on the trading floor, Russell? I don't know if you knew him or not, but he, this little guy who was, you know, a little touched, and he, I don't know what that word even means anymore, but...
Yeah,
He worked for the CBOE, and at the OEX, Lewis, if you did a trade with a book, they just do the trade, and afterward, when you did a trade, if I did a trade with you and you were LAR... I'd put LAR on there, and then I'd have to put your house, your first stop, or Morgan Stanley, wherever the hell you were. So the thing would clear. It would clear to you, but it had to go to your clearing firm first, right? So even today, that's you have to know the house you're trading with. If you're trading, that's what clearing firms do. Well, Harold knew everybody, and he'd walk around and give everybody a list of, I did 100 lot, well, there's going to be 10 Morgan Stanley, 15 Chicago Corp. Oh. You know, so he'd give you that list so you could write it down so everything would clear. So he knew everybody, but he never touched the trade or anything, right? So somehow or another, he was a guy that got... Remember Soldier of Fortune? Is that magazine still around, Russell?
I don't think it's still around, but I know what it is, yeah.
But I don't think they print it anymore. But anyway, he ends up going out to a Soldier of Fortune convention in Las Vegas. And he really liked me, so he races up with all these pictures. You wouldn't have believed these idiots. Well, first of all, G. Gordon Liddy gave like the keynote speech, right? And he's up there with these two incredible-looking babes. And all of a sudden, the babes are hanging around World Herald, who's got to be, 5'1". So then they buy all these, mortars and machine guns at the convention. And the Las Vegas Fire Department allows them to tow some old car out in the desert, and the fire truck follows them out there. And these guys get to lob their mortars and their machine guns at the car, and if this car got in fire, there'd be a practice for them to put the car out. I'm watching this stuff, and I'm going... This is crazy. And this was the 90s? Is it?
Yeah.
It must still be going on somewhere, right? God, it's so different than my world.
And before they blew that shit up, that stuff up, they were just doing a whole lot of chemicals.
Yeah, but how do you, I didn't know you could I didn't know you could buy a mortar. I mean, can you?
I didn't know you could buy a mortar either.
God.
But I need to maybe add that to my arsenal.
Oh, God.
Oh, I thought I was muted. What's up?
So, Rissa, you love it at Purdue. Are you going to the game this weekend?
I'm not going to the game this weekend, but I do love it at Purdue.
I was there once. I liked the place. I mean, I thought it was pretty neat. I mean, I don't know if anybody who said a bad word about it that ever went there.
You have it. No, the only thing I've ever heard, and I don't agree with this one now, is that Purdue is the place that fun goes to die. But I went to parents' weekend with my daughter last weekend, and I think she's having the right amount of fun.
Well, you're supposed to have fun in college.
Well, but I think she's having the right amount of fun because I actually texted her a couple of things about this morning, and actually asked her about the more popular engineering degrees. That's where I got that answer. I mean, she's up and she's heading to calculus right now.
Well, West Lafayette's got to be a lot more fun than South Bend in the early 70s. Good Lord.
What did they do to you at South Bend in the early 70s?
Talk about a dead town. Studebaker just left. Bendix was kind of leaving. Oh. They were the part that went over the fence last. They were in trouble. I mean, and gradually they've kind of come out of it some, but the unemployment. It never really got violent, but it was just the unemployment. It was just a dead place. Everybody left.
This is kind of your age, but one of the things that I deal, and boy, is this off topic, but... what did the Vietnam War do to higher education as far as the demographics go?
Well, Let's just say it was...
Because we're experiencing some funny demographic things around birth rates and stuff.
Well, you ended up... Yeah. A lot of it was things that went with it. All of a sudden, let's say teachers got a deferment. So for the first time in, like, forever, because I was on doing my janitor stuff at the school board, you had a huge influx of young male teachers into, like, grammar schools in the city.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Which was... I don't think that was all that positive, to be honest with you, because guys, and I think teaching for you guys, and I can just tell by talking to you, it's an obsession. It's something you both really want to do.
Yeah.
I mean, we're talking about some 22-year-old is teaching second grade because he didn't want to get shot at, which I can understand that part, but it totally changed the dynamics of a lot of stuff in jobs around that. In terms of students, there were people that were in college that obviously didn't want to be there because you get drafted unless you were a student.
Right.
In the year I turned 18, I think it was, I think Nixon, I don't know who the hell was in office, but the deal was they got rid of student deferments and they went to the lottery system, but if you were drafted, you could be drafted out of school, which not many guys in Notre Dame were. They were pretty lucky on the lottery. But I know some friends from the South Side that were, but then you didn't go to Vietnam. One of my buddies used to work here at PTI, was a truck driver in Europe for 2 years, and another guy was a tank mechanic in Alaska, of all things. I didn't even know we had tanks in Alaska, but we do. So none of those guys went to NAM, but even that, being gone for 2 years, you come back, the girls you used to go out with are all married, the people from Vietnam, most of them, I say most of them, a lot of them, is never fit back in because you were gone between ages 18 to 21, which really changes the whole world when you come back. That's assuming you didn't have Agent Orange landing on your head and everything else, and you had all your limbs. It was a matter of fact, I would say maybe 1 week, maybe we'll get Jan Flanagan in as well. Rissa, you're too young, so are you...
I wanted to chime in. I have a girlfriend who was getting a degree in psychology, and she did her postdoc in the 70s, and she worked with young men who were in Vietnam and some young men who were able to skirt going to the war. And the men who skirted going to the war also had issues because they have survivorship guilt. And she dealt with, and this is the first time really PTSD was forthcoming and getting attention to it. And that's what she did her postdoc work. And she interviewed and worked with all of these people post-Vietnam. And it's just fascinating the challenges of that time period for young men and young women, but really she focused on young men. As they come back from either war or from however they were able to get around it, and then try to reassimilate themselves into society, it was
a very, very, very difficult. Plus, people called them losers. People spat on them in airports, that type of thing. Would you mind next week? I won't have any other guests, just you guys. And for our hour, would you mind we talk about that for 15 minutes? Because I was fortunate enough to have a high draft number, all right? So, but the amount of abuse, matter of fact, one of the ladies was on, we went with, what was her name, Diane Kelly, the one day, the lady who does the Fisher House, Russell.
I thought
you were for a few minutes. Well, she's does a lot of work out at Maywood, which is one of the big veterans hospitals, and one of the things, they specialize really in two things. One is, fake legs and arms and stuff for people, and they also are the big cancer center. Now, if you got burn problems, you go to San Antonio. And she says the amount of cancer of people that were in Vietnam is off the chart. And of course, in this country, like it or love it, or lump it or don't like it, I would hope that we at least most of us like it. You can't get any of that information out of our government. So, me being the knucklehead that I am, I go online. And unbeknownst to a lot of people, is we talked South Korea into sending a lot of troops into Vietnam with us. Same way we talked Europe into Desert Storm, the guys that are now become our enemies, that actually helped us out. It's a editorial comment. But in Korea, it takes you 2 seconds to find out that the cancer rate in the country is 25% roughly. Cancer rate for anybody who was in Vietnam, whether you're a soldier or not, is 29%. And it's significantly worse. Now, you can talk about Agent Orange, you can talk about those things. Whatever it is, it is a hole in this country that the only... In another 20 years, you know, all of us that were part of it will be dead. You know, and that maybe that'll close the book on it. But right now, if you've ever gone to Washington to go to the memorials, you can go to World War II one, and the Korea one's real nice. World War II is very impersonal. I don't know who the hell designed that. Korea's pretty good. You go to the Vietnam one, anybody who walks down that, because it's half underground, you walk down there and walk up. I don't know. I'm not a ghost person. I'm not even, you know, an extraterrestrial life kind of person. If the hair doesn't stand up on the back of your neck, something's wrong with you. Something is about that place. There's still flowers. There's still people crying at the wall because that was their dad. I won't say the creepiest. It's the most. I don't know. Anything has ever hit me more psychologically.
It's overwhelming.
Yes.
Is what you're trying to end, so especially because it's your generation too.
There's something there. I don't care if you're 4 years old; you got to feel it.
Yeah,
and you got to think those are individual people.
Yeah,
yeah.
When you think about again, those are individuals that are up there. It's no longer this idea that it's a mass of people or the sheer number. And again. I'm associated, my dad also had a high draft number. And my dad has a very common name. So I was able to actually find his number or his name up there. It wasn't him, he just happens to have a common name. But the reality of that, it could have happened to him. And this other poor man, it did happen to.
Yeah.
And this is an actual person who didn't have a choice in it, probably didn't have a say in it. And now, sacrifice, the greatest sacrifice you could have. It's truly overwhelming.
We have a Purple Heart sitting in the office here from my uncle who got his head blown off in World War II, which is, you know, it just sits there and you look at it every once in a while. But you know what's even creepier about the Vietnam thing is, and I cannot find this to save my life, but because I used to run all this stuff off. You know, my brother said I'm killing too many trees, so... I try and save it, and every once in a while I lose my bookmarks, whatever. There was an article written by somebody who must have been an actuary, and how he got this information is we first started the show, so it had to be like 12, 15 years ago. And he did some kind of a workup. How he got this stuff, I don't know how you get this, Russell, but he somehow had a roster of pretty much everybody who had been in Vietnam, from participants to contractors to salesmen to God knows what else. Somehow he got all their ages, and he did a prediction based on all the ages of how many of them, let's say this was 2014, for lack of a better term, 325,000 people actuarially were dead that should not have been dead, just based on their ages. And it almost didn't matter whether you were a soldier or whether you were a contractor. Whether it was the drugs, the defoliants, whatever it was, all you had to do was be near the place, it seemed. It was just such a whatever. I mean, anyway, let's talk a little bit about it next week because we're running over time, but it is so scary. I mean, I got to believe that the generation where people in, you know, Afghanistan, we lost people. We also got a bunch of people running around with, a few years ago, I used to still jog on the lakefront. Or say every day or every other day, you'd see somebody jogging with no legs. You sit there and go, I better stop complaining about stuff because look at this guy and he's not letting it bother him, or this lady. I mean, it's nobody pays any attention to any of this stuff, which is pretty scary, isn't it?
It is.
Anyway, guys, I think the rumor has it, and I don't know if regarding this death in Utah, it might have been a competing right-wing group. You ever heard of a guy named Nick Fuentes?
That's not true.
You don't think so?
I heard that the first day. That's not true at all.
Well, this kid.
Don't repeat that.
All right,
not true. It's not true.
Okay.
Don't.
But what do we know? What the motive is?
Well, it's not. Nick Fuentes had nothing to do
with it. I didn't say he did. But
okay, I'm just saying that. That's a complete. This guy, this person was, I mean, mentally ill to say the least.
Without a doubt.
Very fixated on the trans issue, and the trans community really did not like. I mean, he was living with a guy that was in the process of transitioning that was his partner. That's what the topic was. Everybody and their mother can continue. To try to come up with some other reason happened.
I did not realize that there was a massive competition for people in the far right. That's my revelation. I didn't realize.
You know, that people said the exact same shit when Rush Limbaugh started to go down, that look at all these guys trying to steal his spot. And you know, I that's not what's going on here.
All right, well, I mean,
Nick Fuentes didn't have anything to do with it.
I never said he did.
You just did.
No, I didn't. I said
you just did, Chief.
You just did.
You said, what's this rumor about this Nick Fuentes guy? What I said was
the kid supposedly, in addition to looking at the other stuff, was looking at a lot of.
Yeah, he was looking at Nick Fuentes.
I never said that
targets. He was on a target list along with two or three other people.
Everybody has an opinion, and the kid hasn't talked yet, so I guess we'll figure this out. But I mean, I don't care who the guy is. He doesn't deserve to be shot. I mean, why anybody would ever think that it's a good thing? The kid was. I don't agree with a lot of stuff he said, but the fact is, he's out there. He's debating with people. That's America to me. Have you ever
watched like a full appearance of him, like sat and watched the 2 hours that he would do at a university?
It doesn't matter. He doesn't deserve to be shot.
No, I'm saying I don't think he deserved to be shot at all.
I said that. I don't either. Nobody does.
But the thing is, if you watched him, and my wife and I almost like separated over this. If you actually watched him and listened to him unfiltered. And then you see what people said that he said. There is such a disconnect there that it is ridiculous.
Larissa, can I lab this one on Russell? You can be the judge. I do this every morning, right? It's just a small podcast. I have terrific people on it, like you guys.
Mm-hmm.
And I have the same debate with Kevin a lot. It's not what somebody says. It's what people hear. And the really good people can say one thing and make it seem like they said something else. I'm not saying they did it on purpose, but they can say one thing and make it seem like they said something else, and especially if your stuff is picked up by either the extreme right or the extreme left and you let them do the interpretation for you, by the time what you said makes it to the population, it bears no resemblance to what you actually said. Larissa, comment on that, please.
Yeah, but I think he was really focused on helping people find Christ. And so if that's your focus and your goal, you're not necessarily going to be as worried about how people are going to manipulate your message. You're going to be worried and more focused on what God thinks of your message and how God is interpreting it. You're not going to be concerned with necessarily the masses.
Okay. I've learned that I never give investment advice on the show. You can't do that because you guys are not my clients, and nobody, you know, a lot of my clients are listeners. But if I went out and comment something about it, so you say, what about IBM? I could say, I like the company, blah, blah, blah. I don't know whether it's a buy or a sell. That's one thing. But if I start talking about, I don't know how they made it to 257, although that's the market and so forth, you might have 15 people say, hey, Chief Guy said IBM's a sell. No, I didn't. But if that's what they heard, you know what? That's what I said. And it's hard for people who don't do this every day to understand that. But people who like to manipulate other people understand that very well. And I'm not saying he's one of those people. But people like to be right on the edge. You know, what was the king? Was it Henry the something something? Well, nobody rid me of this meddlesome priest. Oh, my God, you shot the guy or killed the guy? Right? Was that Shakespeare? We're talking about Thomas of Becket. The king said, would nobody rid me of this meddlesome priest? The next day they said they killed him. He goes, oh, I never told you to kill him. Well, okay. Somebody said, somebody thought you did, right?
Yeah.
Anyway, you guys are the best. Russell, are you here or are you there?
I'm here. I'm in the Western Burbs.
Now, when you go by West Lafayette, do you guys meet for a burger or something?
It depends. It depends. We'll probably see each other in a week or two. Every once in a while, I'm going to stop by. I stop by and see Emmy, and if Larissa's around, my daughter, and if Larissa's around, we'll see her too.
I would. I don't have any plans. Depends. Don't have any plans to go that way. But if I ever did, boy, a cup of coffee with Dr. Demiak would be high on my list.
I'm sure it would be.
Now, you don't want me sitting in class. You know, I'd be sitting in the back row with like a tomato or something.
To throw it?
I would never do that.
Just, I don't agree with that.
What are you just talking about? So how many class? What's your 30 seconds? What classes are you teaching? I think you might have told us last time, but refresh us.
I'm teaching investments, retirement planning, and estate planning.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Good for you. Good for you. And this is on undergrad or grad two?
This is all undergrad.
Do you?
And I'm very much enjoying my undergraduate students.
Is this what year would everybody be, Russell? That's not freshman year. It'll be like junior year or something.
My students are all graduating seniors.
Okay, well, that's even better. That's cool.
Yeah. All right. Well, they're sort of grown up.
Yeah, well, thanks to the both of you. I mean, Russell was not big on freshmen the last time he...
Freshmen are tough.
Okay. Yeah, that can be difficult.
SP Futures unchanged. Oh, well, Russell, quarter point or half today?
Oh, quarter point, but and I actually I don't think we rally off of it.
I don't think we do either.
So we'll see. I don't know if we go down, but I don't think we rally off.
All right, thanks guys. So back tomorrow, Stacks and Jacks.
Thank you.
That's all, folks.